So welcome to this episode of Home Centered Sunstone, where you get to enjoy a weekly Sunstone Symposium session from the comfort of your own home, which is the only place you're comfortable anymore. So for this week's episode, Sunstone board member Blair Osler has helped me to gather together some smart people who are used to thinking about the future, because we're going to be talking about possible Mormon futures after, or at least during interludes of the COVID-19 pandemic. So what we're going to be talking about is, what kind of changes do we think the LDS Church will go through, both institutionally and at a grassroots level? So as I mentioned, our panelists include Blair Osler, as well as Michael Ann Gardner and Carl Youngblood. And I was wondering, would you each be willing to introduce yourselves briefly in that order?
Hi, everyone. It's me, Blair. I serve on the Sunstone Board. I serve on the board of the Mormon Transhumanist Association and the Christian Transhumanist Association. So anything that has to do with future and theology and all sorts of weird things like that, I'm definitely on board with. And I brought a couple of pals with me today who I'm really excited for you guys all to talk with.
I'm Michael Ann Gardner. I'm the current CEO of the Mormon Transhumanist Association. I've served in that role for about 2 years. So we work on a lot of different projects that relate to all kinds of cool stuff that are about the tech world and in futurism and the future of religion and humanity, and looking in particular at what happens as we incorporate technology more and more with our daily practices, our religious practices, and especially with our bodies, how that changes who we are as a species and like whether or not we evolve. And that's kind of what the organization is all about. And I'm sure we'll talk more about that later.
Hi guys, I'm Carl Youngblood, and I'm one of the co-founders of the Mormon Transhumanist Association. Really excited to be joined by my peers in the association today, and also a big Sunstone fan. I've been reading Sunstone materials for quite a while. And I work in my day job as a software engineer for Amazon Web Services. So I've been kind of a tech geek most of my life, and I think part of what attracted me to transhumanism in the beginning was observing so many interesting changes in technology and the way it was affecting the human condition, and noticing parallels between these changes and some of the things prophesied by Joseph Smith and other leaders of the LDS Church in about the latter days. And noticing interesting, weird, parallels, even though they were cloaked in slightly different language. And the, as I was discussing this with friends and colleagues, we eventually formed the MTA, as we call it. And it's been going strong now for over about 15 years almost. So yeah, we're really, really excited to be here today.
All right. Thanks for joining me, everyone. I really appreciate you taking a few, hopefully just an hour out of your lives for this. We'll try not to go too long. But we had actually planned to stream this episode the Thursday before General Conference, but we put it off because we thought the general authorities will have some interesting things to say about the pandemic. But then we listened to General Conference and they said almost nothing. And so we had to come back with what we had and talk about the material that we came up with ourselves. So we tried to listen to the prophets. The prophets didn't give us anything to work with, so you have to listen to us. Some of the stuff that we're going to be talking about will be mostly how we're going to be dealing with it where we are, as wards, as people. And we're also going to be going into really fun territory at the end for our refreshments. We're going to be talking about, what's the possibility of the church instituting virtual temple ceremonies? And if they don't do that, what might temple ceremonies look like during and after the pandemic? So make sure you stay tuned for that. But to start out, let's talk about being together. I noticed that at the beginning of our social distancing efforts, when the church closed down Sunday meetings, which was March the 14th, a meme was going around showing two pictures of Olivia Newton-John from the movie Grease. The first was her as her Pollyanna self, before she fell for John Travolta. So she's in her pastel clothing. She has a big smile on her face and these adorable blonde bangs. And under the picture, it says, "Mormons, 1 week with no church." And then the second picture is of Olivia in a black jacket with heavy eye makeup and aggressive hair. And between her fingers are a cigarette. And under that picture was the caption, "Mormons, 6 weeks after no church."
A member of my ward is actually the one who created that meme.
No.
Shayla Whipple Franson. And so I feel like I have this very small claim to fame for her.
That's incredible. You must be in a really cool ward.
It is a pretty cool ward, actually.
I'll have to come visit sometime when we're back as wards again. So anyway.
If it ever happens. No.
This episode is being streamed the Thursday before that fateful 6 week mark. And so I'm here to encourage all of my LDS friends, please post a picture of yourself in a black jacket with heavy eye makeup and aggressive hair to your social media accounts on Sunday, just to freak everyone out. But the fact is, we Brighamites, we Salt Lake Mormons, have not met as wards for more than a month now. And that's quite a change from our usual get to church or die trying attitude. Going to church, as far as I was ever told, was, you know, pretty essential to your salvation. And it was also one of the things that gave wards their cohesive power. We saw each other a lot. We were just friends on Sunday. We saw each other all the time. And, you know, we were helping each other. We were making sure that everybody was okay. And we also made sure that everyone was saying the correct things in Sunday school. We made sure that everyone was dressed properly. And we took notes of who took the sacrament. You know, there was a lot going on during those meetings. And now we might see each other's posts on the ward Facebook group, or maybe some of our wards have a virtual Sunday school. But 90% of our contact with our wards is gone. And so what kind of results do you guys think this lack of Sunday meetings is going to have on the LDS populace? Will this lead to like belief fragmentation or retrenchment or cannabis jello recipes? What do you think? Anybody?
So if I could share just a little bit of what I've observed in my own life, I've been participating with a group of friends and relatives who, and the Sunday school discussions that we have over Zoom none of my other ward members are in this group. And I've heard of several other groups or families who are doing it this way, where it's either more family-centered or family/friend-centered. And what I've observed, at least in our practices, is that it's a little more to my liking in terms of the kinds of discussions that we have and the directions we like to take some of the Sunday school lessons. So it seems like I'm seeing a bit of a fragmentation and a bit of more, I'm enjoying our Sunday school discussions a little bit more than I typically would in a ward setting. Not always, but a lot in many cases. So maybe it will be a little bit of a letdown if we ever go back to that, the format that we've been used to before. Just a thought.
One of the things that I was thinking about is how difficult it's going to be to get some people to actually go back to church. Because if you are someone who was maybe on the fence before, and maybe it's not even faith crisis related or intellectual disagreement or anything, I mean, if you think about it, it's just really hard for parents, especially if you have lots of young kids, just to get to the pews and get your toddlers quiet in the pews. And this kind of like nice break of being able to just have church at home with your kids, tailor it to your kids, or be able to just go outside and go for a hike and things like that. I think the church is actually going to have a really hard time getting some people to come back to the pews. There's already going to be your solid base of people who are going to come back no matter what. But I guess I'm also thinking about this too, as far as like younger generations, like millennials. If you look at Pew Research trends, like millennials in general are just kind of leaving established religion as far as like attendance and ritual, even though they still have strongly held beliefs. And I could see this long break of no church being like the thing that's like, oh, maybe I can just worship independently and do my own thing, and I don't have to get all six of my kids ready for church or whatever.
Yeah, definitely.
It's interesting to think, though, about, like, I don't know, from sort of, like, I think about this a lot because I resonate a lot with what Carl is saying about being able to sort of self-select the kinds of people that you're with. And in some ways, like I dream or I daydream about how my church experience would be more enjoyable if I could be more like a Baptist or a Presbyterian and go find my own congregation with a pastor that I self-selected. But at the same time, like, you know, there's a lot of research that shows that kids that grow up, for example, in like economically mixed neighborhoods usually develop a lot more compassion. And I think you could probably extend a comparable argument to, you know, kids who grow up in like mixed political or like mixed viewpoint situations. And so I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm kind of at a point where I don't necessarily want to be a hard nose about, like, you know, you need to get to church with people that you don't like just for its own sake, right? But there's something to it that, I mean, I think most people aren't necessarily thinking that long-term and sort of holistically about their religious worship experience versus just like Blair was saying, like, how do I get through this Sunday? But I would hope that people would, and that they would think sort of about what's the global experience that I want to have.
Yeah, and I should add that even though there are aspects of this new way of practicing in our homes that are appealing, there is a side of me that kind of feels benefit. It's like that those painful but good things that you sometimes have to go through, where you have to grapple with people who feel differently than you do about things, and where over the course of time, after getting used to their gruff exterior, you're like, I actually have a certain kind of respect for that person, you know. And so I definitely value that aspect of the geographic practice that we have. And we're not getting it right now. So it's a really good observation.
So far the things that I've heard is that we're definitely going in a fragmentation direction. A lot of people are liking it. Are you guys gonna go back to church after this is over?
I think I will, okay. Personally.
Maybe if they ordain women, I will.
Okay, all right. Well, that's all you want.
On a lot of levels, it has nothing to do with technology or COVID.
Yeah, I think each of us maybe are in a slightly different situation even before this happened, right? So
it's true. Yeah. Actually, if you guys don't mind, would you mind if I argued with you? Can you stand it?
Okay. Please do. We like that. We like respectful disagreement.
So I actually think that the pandemic will be really good for church attendance, because I actually think that religion is based a lot more on economics than it is on spirituality. And so with this huge economic change, I think there will be a huge religious change as well. Let me tell you what I mean. So if you look back at the last century of the United States, we've been pretty much prospering the entire time, right? And if you look back at the past 20 years, our technological progress has been astonishing. When I first went to college, we still used card catalogs. That's how quickly things have gone ahead. Now, I'd be amazed to find out that any library in North America used a card catalog for anything more than a planter. But these two things together, prosperity and technological progress, have made a really interesting religious bubble. So during the card catalog days, only a few thousand people really took much interest in LDS history and theology. But now, hundreds of thousands of people do. This is partially because of how easy it is to access information, and partially because of the fact that we have the time to think about it because of all this prosperity. So before, you know, you had to be a scholar they have the time, the access. But now you just need to be like a college student or a white collar worker. So the most visible thing that happened because of all this is that a lot of people left the church, not because they lacked interest in it, but because they were so interested in it that they were disappointed by what they found. We've talked about this on Sunstone and stuff like that all the time. We're worried about the whitewashed history, the poor track record of combating racism and sexism and homophobia, and doctrines and policies that are really more interested in maintaining the status quo than in progressing. So the foundational impetus for why a whole bunch of people left the church was simply that they had the time and the access. Without those two things, most of them probably would have stayed. So it's interesting to look back at recent church history and see that the leaders, hello son, see that the leaders saw that this would be the case. For example, in Sterling McMurrin's autobiography, he talks about how the church started sending its seminary and institute teachers to the University of Chicago to learn biblical higher criticism, you know, to actually get them a degree so that they could teach religion. And then when they came home, their worldview was so altered that the church couldn't employ them anymore, and they stopped sending them there. And then Leonard Arrington started to make church historical records more generally available, and they saw the same thing happening. Access to these records spawned alternate interpretations of history that the church had once had complete control over, so they shut that down. But the internet is something that the church doesn't have any control over, and when internet access became ubiquitous, so did alternative interpretations of history and theology, and this led to a mass exodus, time and access. But there was one more thing that played into the exodus, and that was simply that it was affordable. So for most of human history, you stayed in your tribe because that was the best way to survive. Being part of a community meant you had access to more resources. But with our prosperity and technology, we reached a point where a person could never leave her apartment and just survive doing her work online and having groceries delivered. In fact, that's a lot of what we're doing right now. So even though, you know, it was often a wrenching experience to leave Mormonism, it was possible. You wouldn't die. There were plenty of resources around and a larger culture that you could find a place in. So that prosperity has suddenly disappeared. According to, I think it was the New York Times, 22 million people filed for unemployment during the past month. Suddenly, people can't make ends meet because their business or their place of employment was shut down. And the impact on the economy will be enormous. And it will get bigger. And so when things get started, you know, little by little, a lot of things just won't be available anymore. And so suddenly we're being thrust back into that time when you needed a community to survive. A lot of people are going to be sliding down Maslow's hierarchy. Once we had all this time to think about history and theology, and now our thoughts are taken up with survival. And the best way to survive is to have a community. And for all its faults, Mormonism is a really effective community. It's organized. The people in it tend to care about each other. It's a great place to network. There are employment specialists in the stake. And if things get really bad, you know, there are the fast offering funds. The list goes on. So I really wonder if a lot of people who could once survive without a community and left Mormonism because it was affordable, if they'll consider going back when survival is uppermost in their minds. Perhaps they'll see the church as a help rather than a burden. And I'll admit, if my and my wife's income suddenly dried up, I would be a lot more likely to become more integrated with my ward. And I've been going to church, but I think that I'd get more integrated because I'd feel like I was safer somehow. And I wonder if a lot of people will feel that way. What do you think? Will economy overcome not wanting to get the kids to church at 9 a.m.?
I think you're making some really interesting points, and I think it's really important to keep in mind sort of those real effects. But I think the one thing I'm interested to hear, if anybody knows this, or like if anybody has any data to either argue or argue against or for this. My feeling so far is that the majority of people who are losing their jobs tend to be not white collar worker jobs. Like so far, tech companies, anybody who has a computer type work, they can do it from home. I think eventually we're going to see a trickle down effect where those people will lose their jobs as well. But I've been stunned, honestly, at how much the CES letter is to some extent organized by class. I would say that the friends that I have who are lower socioeconomic classes, like less college educated, less income, most of them have never heard of it. It's very much a socially driven document, for example. And so if you overlay the fact that the people who are losing their jobs are like hairdressers and like, you know, food service workers and people in a, I would probably argue, a different socioeconomic class than the four of us, they're probably not also the ones who were leaving the church for the reason that the CES letter lays out. So I think that you're really, I think you're accurate that existential fear, whether that's economic or otherwise, like does drive people to come back to tribes. But I don't know that economics alone is gonna be enough to overcome the specific issues of Mormon intellectual faith crises.
I would just add that, like, my observations to the first question about the first question were mostly focused on very short-term effects that we're experiencing right now. And I honestly think that just because we're so desperate for human contact and interaction when this is all over, that people will like flock to church and to other types of gatherings just because they're like, man, I can't believe it, but I even love Sister Thompson, you know, or whatever it was, whoever it was that was their arch nemesis.
Is that
in the
a
war.
Real person, girl?
No. But, you know, I think that it might take a lot less than we think to get people to come back, actually.
Yeah, I think that it's definitely worth talking about that economics does play an influence on how people congregate into tribes for purely networking purposes. When I think about a lot of my husband's success and career, it's a lot come from Mormon networking, right? But I think that's true of all tribes. So if he were not a Mormon and he were something else and he were at Notre Dame, he would have that network or that thing. And so religion does play an important network, but I don't know if the network necessarily has to come from going back to church in a congregation. I mean, we have things like LinkedIn now. And again, maybe I'm just like the clueless millennial here, but I just feel like we have other ways of connecting and congregating with our tribes. Like my queer tribe, the only time we ever get together in person is when we go to like the affirmation concert or a conference. I called it a concert. They're going to love that. No, the affirmation conference. And so when I think about what do I do when I congregate with my tribe to network and things like that, there are a lot of different ways to do that than besides religion, but you bring up an excellent point that, like, yeah, people will definitely go back to church out of the idea that, you know, we don't have anything else left to do because we're all either unemployed or we're looking to be employed. So that would make sense to me.
Yeah, for sure. I think that there's a lot of luxury with which some people have been able to contemplate departures from their community in times of prosperity. And I'm already seeing a little bit of a few signs, even among disaffected friends who are suddenly, without openly acknowledging that they want to go back to church, at least are making open comments about how different the world is now. And how much more precarious they feel that their situation is.
I think no matter how much you've tried to re-intellectualize your religious experience, I think all of us have that, it's this weird primal fear that we really are in the last days. Like if you're here on the Wasatch Front and you keep getting earthquake after earthquake after earthquake, say that like, y'all, like, chill out, like this is not the last days. Like like, I think even the most intellectual of us is kind of like, yeah, but like, what if? Like, what if it is, right? You know? And that kind of maybe speaks to the economic fear that you're indicating, Stephen, that there's these sort of existential reasons that make us maybe second, like, revisit some of our earlier decisions.
And I think specifically for Mormon transhumanists, we are totally okay with the notion that this is that these are the last days, that, like, in the sense that there are amazing, astounding changes that are happening all around us every day that are the result of an accelerating changes in technology and all of the outgrowth of those things, right?
Right, it's a big driving force in the pandemic, but like, is part of that
climate change, you know, just, I mean, you don't have to even be religious to feel like we live in a world of accelerating turmoil, right? So I think these, even though the language might get more religious, it's like that sense of dread and apocalypse and what the future holds is one that I think we keep, that we maintain even after our faith may shift, right?
I think it's a good point. And one of the things that I was actually kind of surprised about is that the church came out with so little to sort of address how we're going to deal with a pandemic as a church in general conference. Maybe they just didn't have the time. I was under the impression that they were scrambling to put something together, and then it turns out that they didn't. But let's say that they do want to put something together, that they're envisioning new programs, new ways of kind of keeping everybody calibrated, keeping us from fragmenting into a million different groups, a million different Sunday schools. What do you think that they could do to sort of make us feel like a unit again, instead of as a whole bunch of different Sunday school classes where we self-select?
So one thought that I have here is what the church already does in certain areas of the world where there isn't enough of a critical mass of membership for them to congregate normally. I'm aware of, we used to live in Norway. I'm aware of certain branches in northern Norway where people are very, individual members are very far apart from one another, and they would conduct meetings over Skype or some other telepresence application. And also in China, I've heard that. Yeah, that this happens. And what I've heard is that the way they currently practice ordinances like the sacrament of the Lord's Supper is that they say basically if you have a priesthood holder in the home, they can essentially have actual emblems there to be blessed when the prayer is said. And I think they pause for a moment and have them say their individual prayers. And then those who don't just kind of thoughtfully contemplate. But I think that already without adapting anything beyond what they're doing in those areas, you could have some kind of a virtual meeting in a more widespread level, right? So that's a thought anyway.
I think it's very interesting though, right? Because I mean, I think a lot of us like were really stunned when they sort of authorized like small study groups, because like small study groups is how you get, you know, like Denver Snuffer. and like, not that I have anything against Denver Snuffer. I just think, I know the church obviously does, right? And so I just, it's really interesting to me because I feel like with Hinckley, you saw a lot of tech progressivism. And even with Monson, like, let's use the devil's tools. Like, we have to call ourselves, I'm a Mormon, to get our point across, like, let's do it, let's go for it, right? But I feel this weird sort of like progressivism on the one hand with Nelson, where he's like, yeah, like, let's loosen things up, let's decentralize, but at the same time, like, also like a retrenchment, you know, where like, I just think that it's too risky to keep it where you can let anybody be blessing whatever they want in their homes. And I just can't see I can't see that being a long-term thing. To your point, Stephen, there's a certain element of surveillance.
Well, you have to keep everything, you have to keep the software talking to itself. It has to know what the codes are. It has to know all the different parts need to have the same language in order to be able to work together well. So yeah, that was why I was so surprised. I thought they were going to put together a software for us that would really tie everyone up. But in my particular ward, we have like daily Facebook posts and that's about it. We don't have Sunday school or anything. And that just surprised me a lot. I thought that Mormons were more kind of hands-on and cohesive than that. So this has been surprising me. It's kind of fun when Mormons surprise me. I'd totally go for this.
By the way, I feel like I need to rush to the defense. I know that Michael Ann was just speaking facetiously when she said the devil's tools. But I feel like Mormonism, generally speaking, even in our sort of LDS tradition inside of Mormonism, is pretty pro-technology and often speaks as though these tools are reserved for the latter days, you know, to help us accomplish our work. So I feel like, but I mean, I totally get what you're trying to say. I just thought I'd put that little.
No, I mean, and that's where I would hope we could do that. I mean, you know, I could see, you know, like literally every member, I mean, you know, I'm not even like a frequent goer. I still have the Gospel Library app on my phone. Like you could totally like pop up some little, like, here's a worldwide Zoom meeting, right? Or mm-hmm. or I don't know, like there's so many ways in which you could just connect people in that way, or even just giving like a protocol. But I think as part of this sort of decentralization, they seem to be really deferring to state presidents to figure out what to do. And I think the state presidents are kind of like, well, I don't know. And so I think without a grassroots movement of one state president being like, oh, I have this good idea, and then it gets passed. But I also don't know if the state presidents feel like they can do that because they're more used to like this, this correlated experience.
Fascinating actually, because like, what if, you know, how it seems like the church used to be a little bit even more states' rights, so to speak, stakes rights, shall we say, where like the stake presidents used to take a little more initiative and feel a little more autonomy. But lately, as we become more correlated, we might be less prepared for an event like this where suddenly there is more creativity and ingenuity and initiative needed at the local level, right?
Well, less and more, it kind of depends, I think, and forgive me if this was already said because my internet went out for a brief moment, this really goes in line with President Nelson's home-centered church initiatives, right? Like, Nelson also did away with like temple pageants and things that were like on a local level of us doing our own thing. So I don't see that really changing that much. I mean, temporary crisis control, maybe stake presidents, but anything long-term going ahead, it will definitely be correlated and home-centered. I mean, this is just the established pattern of what Nelson has already been doing. So that would kind of be the way I see it. And just another comment on like Mormonism's relationship with technology. Like, we do have a tendency to be relatively pro-tech. But at the same time, I would not say we're a very totally pro-tech organization, in that the church has a pattern of embracing technology that furthers its goals and, more importantly, its authority structures. So if broadcasting the Q15 out to get their message out is going to help, well, you can bet they're going to embrace that technology. If there's radical life extension technology, you bet the brethren are going to take advantage of that technology. If there is abortion technology, transgender technology, anything that really hints at dismantling that authority structure or breaking down the barriers of authority, that technology is going to be condemned and rejected as something that's not, should be a part of Mormonism. So Mormonism does have a tricky relationship with technology, generally pro-science, generally pro-whatever, but at the same time, if it's a science or technology that's threatening the authority structure, you're going to get big resistance for it.
I think this is where it's really important to talk about like kind of what happened when they made the temple from a live thing to a video thing, right? I mean, I think at the time, like, there was and some people who are historians might be able to tell the story better than I can, but there was a real resistance to it, right? Like, we can't put this sacred thing like on video. There is something that's like really inherently weird about that, right? Because it is so pageanty.
It's a mass media technology, right? And that and the endowment used to be like really intimate, and it became mass media in a way, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, and it's really just like in its tone and its feel, it's so locked into 19th century sort of aesthetics, and we just like flipped it around and we put it on, you know, like put it on video. And
even Disneyfied.
Even the most recent videos are these beautiful like motion graphics, right? And I'm just like, I'm waiting for the day when like we make them VR, right? I mean, like, how cool would it be? Like, I'm now literally Eve, and I'm like literally standing across from Adam, right? And I can like, you know, touch the freaking leopard, right? I can feel like the apple, like, and I think that's really cool. Don't laugh at me.
I'm sorry. Cool. No, I'm just cracking up with the idea that now my spouse is even more handsome or beautiful because.
Maybe it still looks like my spouse. I don't know. I mean, like, heaven knows they don't look like the real Adam and Eve. Like, way too. but you know, I mean, that seems really plausible. But then, like, what do you do about the fact that like a VR is like a really personal device? Like, is there room then for the temple ceremony to be taken to other personal devices? I think that's where you get the hard line, right? It's still going to always be going to some kind of physical building that is like, you know, sort of congregated or separated, because you got to maintain a hierarchy, and you got to figure out how to make it personal, how to make it owned by the individual, but still owned by the church at the same time.
So we do have a little bit of precedent for moving towards a virtual setting. I know this is a really weak example, but like, the ways that some of the ordinances have changed to where they used to involve more touching than they do, mm-hmm. and have become more symbolic.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, once you disconnect the physical contact that's taking place in the ordinance, at that point, I kind of think all bets are off in terms of your ability to eventually make that a more telepresence kind of experience. And so I'm not saying that, I kind of agree with you that there will be a bristling if it gets too disconnected, right? Because there is a collective aspect to temple worship, right? But I do think that if you've broken off the physical contact, it does open up the possibility of new ways of doing it.
Let's dive into that. That's really interesting. I had never thought that you could actually be Adam or Eve. That would take the endowment ceremony to an entirely new level. But there's also, as you guys would just point out, the inescapable physical aspect. I mean, you have to touch other people in order to get through the ceremony. What do we do about that if that could possibly spell death, you know?
So telepresence is a really interesting word. And I used to work at Cisco in their telepresence division. So this is something that I've thought about maybe a little more than some. But like, what's interesting about that word over video conferencing or something more, another word that you might choose for it, is that it really is all about immersive experiences that seem as though you are there, right? And they're trying to make it as close as they can to that. So, you know, our team was even had like audio experts who would try to like make microphones that were all in an array so that they could tell where the sound was coming from in the room and try to reproduce that same feeling of where it's coming from. So when you see somebody talk, you're like hearing it as though it were coming from them. And I think this is only the beginning in terms of where they want to go with telepresence. So this idea of being in VR and not touching someone may actually eventually go away, in the sense that it might be, for all intents and purposes, indistinguishable from a physical experience, right?
But I think Stephen's point is a little more immediate, because we're not
right. I'm speaking sort of long term here.
Oh yeah, it's fascinating.
I mean, especially yeah. if you have mostly old people staffing temples, like I mean, like, I think you're gonna have to totally change. I mean, because like, you're very close and intimate, and droplets are flying, right? And I don't know. Like, I was actually honestly surprised at how long it took them to close the temples. It was longer than it took them to close church, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And if you think about it too, the temple does have a pattern of adapting as well. Like, at the veil, there used to be the 5 points of contact, right? Now we only have 1 point of contact or two, depending on what you're doing. But, so there is an established pattern of being like, look, we change the ritual when necessary and in some ways to keep up with the times. You know, we're not naked and blessed anymore. We have shields, but then that changed and people are even more covered during certain parts of the temple. So as far as like, I don't know exactly how that would work, but there is an established pattern of, okay, we can change this a little bit so long as we don't change too much too fast. I mean, because people are like still upset, you know, that like women don't have to veil their faces anymore. But I actually think that's really funny because like, weirdly, we're all being asked to veil our faces and cover our mouths and breathing passages. So I'm thinking, you know, men need to start wearing veils and covering their faces in the temple so they don't spread COVID. And I don't know, you know what I'm saying? Like, weirdly, veils become this thing where everybody's like, hey, were you veiling your face in the temple? Okay, everybody needs to be doing that now, okay?
From a theological standpoint, I mean, it'd actually be really beautiful because one of the arguments that my ex-husband, Don Bradley, always makes is he talks about how, you know, Moses veiled his face. And part of what Joseph was doing with the whole hat thing was like, it was a kind of pseudo veil, right? It was this whole argument about why that is. But, and you get this really beautiful symbolism about approaching deity, about being deity, like when you veil. And the only way in which his sort of argument fell flat for me is that like, well, then why do women have to, but men don't, right? So this like, this something about this doesn't add up. But
are you looking for an answer more sophisticated than because sexism?
I mean, like, I was like trying to argue with Don, who I know is not a sexist, right? Of like, okay, give me your argument, right? Like, maybe like convince me that you're right. But like, I think it actually could be a really beautiful solution. I think it could be beautiful and not just a temporal solution, but a theological expression.
Are we talking about the veil specifically right now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or whether it's like a veil or like a veil, either way, yeah. I think sort of the same symbolism of Moses, of Joseph.
The holy face shield.
Although I gotta be honest with you, if there's a whole lot of veiling going on, there's gonna be a lot more sleeping happening too. The truth.
Okay, so many times, like the minute those lights go down, like I would try so hard, everything I could possibly could, but lights are down, I'm out.
And I also think about like the prayer circle and everything we do in the temple is so physical and we're in contact with people all the time that I think something like that will have to change like on a long-term level. And I wouldn't be surprised if we even switch to a different type of understanding of what the temple symbolism is and what it means. Like, for example, what does it mean to, you know, do temple work for the dead when going to the temple could kill you? We have these really interesting conflicting
we'll
ideas.
We'll hasten your journey.
Right?
You know, I have to say, though, from what little history I've read from this, the 1918 pandemic, there was a good deal of social distancing happening even back then, maybe not quite as strictly or as like ubiquitously as it's happening now. But I think that people went through a phase where they did avoid as much contact as they could. And yet when it seemed to subside, everyone went back to their original habits. And I feel like these habits of hugging and embracing and shaking hands are so deeply ingrained that I honestly, while there certainly probably will be some who abandon the practice forever of shaking hands, I kind of feel like it will be a minority of people once we're out of the woods.
I think you're right.
So anyway, just a thought.
I accidentally stopped my video. I really like what you guys are saying about the theological possibilities of COVID-19. We really should have named the stream that. What are the possibilities that come up from all of this? Because you're right, there's the veiling of the face, there's the distance between everybody, and it actually reminds me of something that was in a book I edited. Moth and Rust. Oh, you can't see it. There you go. Moth and Rust. I forget what it's called. Mormon Encounters with Death. It's got a really, it's a fantastic book. You should absolutely buy it so that I get more than $35 for my royalty checks next year. But there's one really interesting kind of short story-ish thing in there by Jonathan Penny that I feel is almost prophetic, and it's certainly poetic. But it starts really funny because it starts with the words, Riley, known among LDS survivors as the Proclamation on the Zombily, and referred to historians as the Outbreak Prophecy. And essentially, the name of the story is A Voice Not Crying in the Wilderness. And he's basically writing a couple of pages of history of what he thinks might happen if a zombie outbreak actually happened and Mormons were actually interacting with it. And it sounds like a joke, but it's actually gorgeous, kind of for the reasons that you guys have been starting to say. There's a, one of the parts was really interesting. It says, an addendum to the third edition of the General Handbook of Instructions posted on LDS.org, that's how old this thing is, 5 days later, outlined revised worship practices to be implemented with immediate effect. All speech, including greetings, talks, instruction, and prayer, would be whispered because the zombies could hear. And that was how they triangulated on where the living people were. So everybody had to be quiet. Hymns would be read silently, not sung. All non-essential gatherings would be suspended. I told you, prophecy. Including children's meetings, wards and branches would be divided into companies of no more than 3 households or 15 persons, whichever is smaller, definitely dealing with large Mormon families there, that would gather to renew their covenants and testify and nourish each other in isolated and secure places. And it was really interesting how this what he imagined would happen to Mormonism with zombies is kind of what happened with us with this outbreak. But he also delved into some of the beautiful things that came out of it. One of the apostles and all the apostles went back to their original roles, which was to be a missionary and sort of going around and visiting the congregations. And he wrote, the quiet has gentled our natures. Our interactions with the living are characterized by tenderness, respect, and stillness, in stark contrast to our interactions with the zombies, which, when they occur, are marked by swift, decisive, economic, and violent dispatch. And he writes this hymn at the end, which at first you want to laugh at, but it's actually kind of beautiful. I don't know if I could actually convey it goes, the body dies, the spirit flees, the body stands upright, untethered by that righteous spark, reduced to appetite, till second death claims e'en that husk for resurrection's grace. Pray not for death, but twinkling come to heaven's illumined space. For twinkling is a better change from light to better light. Oh, pray for fine and flashing steel. Oh, flee from the shambling night. And so what you guys were talking about kind of reminds me of what's going on here. What are the possibilities that could come about because of the horrific things, all of the changes, all of the new symbols that have suddenly invaded our normal social space? How can we make beautiful things out of that? Because I think we're going to kind of have to.
If I could take a moment briefly to just put in a 30-second plug for prophecy. At the beginning of our discussion, you mentioned that we didn't have the prophets with us. to opine on these topics. Mm-hmm. But I just want to remind us all that, and this is something that really resonates with many of us in the MTA, that Mormonism has a radical conception of prophecy. The Book of Mormon talks about exceedingly many prophets that were among us, prophets like Abinadi and Samuel the Lamanite, who were called from no position of ecclesiastical authority. And when a newspaper reporter asked Joseph Smith, you know, if he was a prophet of God, he said, yes, and so is anyone else with the testimony of Jesus. And so I think early Mormons especially had this radical egalitarian view of prophecy. And so I feel like what we're engaging in right now is, it could be thought of as a type of prophecy. And so we do have the prophets among us. And I'm just going to stand right up and say, you know, we don't necessarily have the same ecclesiastical authority or, you know, right to preside. But we should all be striving to, as Paul said, covet to prophesy, right? So let's do it here. This is exciting. And with that, may we continue into this question of yours. I just had to take that brief aside, if you'll forgive me.
It was beautiful. Thank you. Blair.
Yeah, sorry, my internet is really bad and it's cutting in and out. So hopefully I'm not repeating what anybody has said. But one of the things that came to mind as you were reading that is that our theology is primed with all these beautiful ways to deal with COVID. I think there is something deeply beautiful about the fact that our salvation right now is coming from stillness and from quietness and refraining from congregating. I think of the hymn, "Be still my soul, the Lord is on my side." And there's something deeply beautiful knowing that even though we aren't getting together, even though we aren't in the same room worshiping together, that there is still this sense of community as far as like, we are in solidarity with each other. We are in stillness with each other. And that is the salvation for the time being. And to me, there's something profoundly beautiful in that. And that is part of our theology too, this idea of just, you know, patience is a virtue, right? It's not one of my virtues, but it is a virtue. But that's really beautiful to me. Moving forward into like bigger, broader theology, like I would love to see temple ceremonies change drastically. And this is like my Mormon transhumanist coming out hardcore, that the whole point of, well, not the whole point, one of the points of the temple ritual is to redeem our dead and to go through for our dead ancestors and dead people and redeem them in this spirit of the hearts of the children were turned to their parents, and all these things are going to bring about the salvation of the entire world. And for me, while those are really beautiful symbolic gestures, what if we actually invested more time, money, ritual, and service into actually making those things a reality? Like, what are we doing to actually redeem our dead, to bring them back? What kind of technologies are we investing in? What are we doing to make this a reality? Is this just a nice thing we go do in the temple? Or are we serious about that? Are we gonna invest in radical life extension technology? Could the church donate $1 billion to figure out how to stop death, how to stop aging? Like, this is all in our theology. We're all prophesied that we're all gonna do this and make earth the renewed to a paradisical glory and everything. But yet we have to actually do it. And I feel sometimes our rituals, especially like temples, can sometimes get in the way of that. They're beautiful up until the point where they are a catalyst to actually making those things a reality. But like, I'm sorry, Masonic handshakes in a temple isn't going to bring back your dead loved one. Like, it's a beautiful thought, but that's not going to happen. We actually have to like do that. And so I know this is crazy Mormon transhumanist talk for most people who don't sit in our circles and talk about anti-aging technology, resurrecting the dead and things like that. But I'm telling you, fast forward a million years, the humans that evolve from us, they will have godlike powers that we cannot even imagine. We will be like crawling hominids compared to what they are capable of manifesting. So I see a lot of potential and a lot of room for creativity. And I hope that COVID provides a space where people are like, what really matters in my religion? What am I really doing here? Do I really believe in these prophecies or not? What is this role that it's fulfilling in my life? And why am I participating in it? Anyway, that was a really long blurby, but those are my thoughts.
I think it's interesting, right? Like, I mean, I think I what I felt most moved by in the hymn that you read, Stephen, was sort of like, don't long for death, but long for twinkling. I mean, maybe I misunderstood what the author was trying to say with that, but the way that I took it was like, I don't know, if you get twinkled, raptured, whatever, you don't get zombified, right? You get just, it just solves this problem.
Transfigured in the twinkling of an eye.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I haven't seen anyone actually explicitly express this, but usually when we get these kinds of, you know, so I'm involved a lot with like environmental movements and Latter-day Saints and environmental movements. And one of the big things that we hear a lot is like I climate change, like I just can't, like Jesus is just going to come back and like that's how the earth is going to get renewed. And I'm constantly trying to help people understand that, like, okay, no, that's not quite how it works, right? And I think that people think that way because it feels so big, right? Like it feels so big to deal with climate change. It feels so big to deal with a zombie. It feels so big to deal with COVID-19 that I think we often just sort of wish that we could just have something magical that takes care of it for us. And one of the most powerful articles that I read about this talked about COVID is the need to be able to endure, right? To realize, to kind of accept that this is our reality, to accept that we're in this probably a lot longer than any of us want to be. And the more we're sort of just like waiting for this magical external solution, the less resilient we're actually going to be and the less we'll actually be able to faithfully endure through this. And I think theologically, I really hope that this helps Wasatch Front Latter-day Saints realize that they're not immune, right, to the world's perils. They're not immune to sort of apocalyptic experiences. I hope it helps Latter-day Saints worldwide just become more grounded in what Blair was saying about how much it takes personal action in addition to personal faith to actually endure.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Carl.
Yeah, I was just playing, extending what you guys have said there. I think that when we really look at what the ultimate goal that the scriptures attribute to God, which is to bring to pass the immortality and eternal life of humanity, that cannot be achieved through like an involuntary process, right? It's something that needs to involve our cooperation, and that any kind of salvation that is unearned and misunderstood is not real salvation or exaltation from a Mormon perspective, because if you're in no better position than you were when it began, then you haven't progressed at all, right? So people who are thinking of the renewal of the earth and all the prophecies of the latter days as something that is merely imposed externally on humanity have really not thought it through that well from a Mormon perspective, because Mormonism is all about humanity's exaltation and not just just us as creatures being like put into a nice fun playpen that we get to inhabit for the rest of all eternity. We really...
COVID's an opportunity to become more compassionate and become more impatient and endure more, right? To become
right.
more godly.
Right. And so just to finish, like that means that whatever kinds of wonderful visions of the future we have are things that we have to be involved in, we have to participate in, we have to work towards, right? So I'm so with you both on that thought that hopefully we will start to think through the ramifications of our theology and realize that these trials that we're experiencing are giving us that opportunity to birth a better world, right?
I just wanted to add to all that goodness that was just shared by both of you all. I love how Michael Ann mentioned, I hope that the Wasatch Front realizes they're not just going to be immune to COVID-19. You think about the people who were kindly and well-intentioned trying to pass sacrament to different families and going into their homes and blessing it because of a lack of priesthood authority in the home or whatever, or I should say ordained priesthood authority in the home. And people like putting out guaranteed blessings. I promise you, you will not be infected by COVID if you let me come give you the sacrament, right? We chuckle at it, but at the same time, I want to also nuance it out a little bit and say that while I think that's definitely a misguided faith, it is most certainly a powerful faith. And what I'm a better direction, and maybe not necessarily poke fun at it, because I kind of want to poke fun at it too. You can't like pray your way out of COVID. But so just a short story. I went to a missionary farewell, and this missionary was talking about how important it was to read the Book of Mormon and how it would change your life. But he said he didn't have time to read it. And because he didn't have time to read it, the Book of Mormon was so powerful that if he opened it on his nightstand dresser, just having it opened alone would change him, and he would be able to know of the truthfulness of it. So the missionary did this thing. He opened the Book of Mormon, left it on his nightstand, and he bore his testimony how it changed his life and how he knew that it made him a better person. It made it kinder to his brother. It made him more compassionate, so on and so forth. Now, we can all sit and poke fun. Oh, awesome. So you open a book and it made you a nicer person. But that's the power of faith and the power that non-religious people can't grapple with, because that kind of profound belief that I can literally be immune to COVID if you take the sacrament, that belief is crazy powerful. So what I really want to do in my Mormon transhumanist mind is I want to take that kind of belief. I want to take that kind of power. That power, if I just leave open my Book of Mormon, that we're going to be able to like all be nicer people. I want to take that power and harness it towards real, tangible goals. What if we actually believed we could bring back people from the dead? Like, what if we actually believed that? So much so that we stopped doing handshakes and instead started investing in technologies and started taking the necessary actions and steps toward making these things a reality. And that's the power of religion that non-religious people, I don't think, have fully recognized. They like to make fun of it. And I think making fun of it is a mistake, because that power is just as real as any other power, because it's totally shaping the reality of the world we live in right now. So I want to take that power and I want to funnel it into a very productive and healthy expression.
And it seems like now might be the perfect time for that, since it's on everybody's mind so much. The way you guys have been describing this, COVID almost seems like sort of a sealing ceremony that has brought the entire world family together, since none of us are immune and we all have to be in this together and figure it out together. Maybe it's sort of a catalyst for what you guys are thinking about.
It's been an amazing leveler. I mean, one of the things that's surprising to me is how the differences in the classes in our society have been, to some extent, obliterated by, I mean, there's still obviously clear differences, but everyone's afraid. Sorry, what?
Boris Johnson can get it, and so can a truck driver.
Exactly. Everyone's vulnerable, right? And there's something about, you know, it's like, it reminds me of that quote from A Christmas Carol, where Charles Dickens says that it was the one time of the year when everyone looked at one another as fellow passengers to the grave, right? And I think that this event has done that to some degree. And it's really shifted the Overton window very quickly in terms of like what political possibilities are out there and what types of arranged social arrangements we might consider collectively, right? Things that people weren't even talking about or that seems like utterly radical before it hit are being actively discussed, you know, and contemplated. So I really hope that even though I think we're only seeing the beginning of the troubles that this will cause in terms of economic challenges and repercussions, I also really fervently hope that from this all will, that this can be a catalyst for more progress in good directions as well.
Amen, brother. Those sound like closing words to me. Does anybody else have closing words?
Yeah, I'll just say, did we scare you too much? Will you ever have Mormon transhumanists on your show again?
Actually, you guys kind of reminded me of Marshall McLuhan. He wrote in the preface to, what's it called? Understanding Media? I don't remember what it's called. His first book. He said, when I was first bringing this to editors, they said, only 20% of a book can be new material. The rest needs to be what people already know. Otherwise, people aren't going to follow you. And so being with you guys is like being with Marshall McLuhan, who insisted that 90% of his book be new material. And of course, he turned out to be pretty right. So, you know, we might as well listen to the people who are looking far, far into the future. I think it, I mean, isn't that what we're supposed to be doing as Mormons, looking far out there?
Well, we got to keep that eternal perspective, don't we?
Exactly. Yeah, you guys aren't even going eternal. All you're doing, you're only looking about 500 years into the future.
Yeah. Come on.
Step it up. All right. Well, thanks everyone for joining us. And just in case you're wondering how you can support more live streams like this one, I'm happy to report that we actually have more ways for you to donate. You can now give livestock, produce, and first editions of the Book of Mormon. We accept all those things now. You can also install Givelify on your phone. I don't know if you've heard of this before, but it makes it really easy to send a donation our way, and that's spelled Givelify. And you can give to other nonprofits over that too. So go and download that if you want to, or if you want to do it the old-fashioned way, you can get on the interwebs and go online at sunstone.org/donate. So thank you each once again for such an interesting look. I don't think there's anything like this podcast, well, or this live stream anywhere in Mormondom. We have done something truly unique today, and I thank you guys for being with me. So wave goodbye to the people on out in Facebook land.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Stephen.
All right. Now I'll see if I can figure out how to end this meeting.